How many questions did Vice President Kamala Harris not answer in a Today Show interview? What new federal legislation would create school choice for every low-income American family whose public schools are not open for in-person education 5 days a week? And, drumroll, what U.S. city schools may have changed 30 kids' grades? No, actually, 60 kids' grades. No, actually, it was 90,000 kids' grades. Those stories and so much more on this week's Cold Weather, Warm-Hearted Random Assignment. Welcome to Random Assignment. I'm Bob Bowden of Choice Media. Our website is choicemedia.tv, where you can also sign up for the best weekly email blast in the industry every Friday. And that man, that's Corey DeAngelis of Reason Foundation. And Corey, how are you?
Hey, doing well.
A lot of news, so much news this week. Goodness gracious. Where do we even begin?
Yeah, well, let's start at the, you wanted to talk about something going on in an interview today with Kamala Harris. And I've seen a couple of quotes from it, but I haven't gotten to see.
That you're going to see this live with the viewers and respond. We broke it up into three clips. On the Choice Media Twitter, we actually have it as one big clip, but we figured we'd break it into three here. This is a stunning interview from Kamala Harris. I'm telling you, maybe people will say this is through a partisan lens that I conclude that. So decide for yourself. But there are a myriad of questions that she just does not answer. From Savannah Guthrie on the NBC News Today show. It happened this morning. And so we'll start with the first clip, with the question being, was the CDC wrong? She repeats the question, and we'll get to all hear how Kamala responds. Was the CDC wrong?
Let's talk about schools. We got a lot of parents watching right now, maybe with their kids right next to them because they're not going to school. The CDC a few days ago finally put out some long-awaited guidance on how schools could safely reopen. But here's the thing. They tied it directly to the rate of infection in any given community. And I'm going to put a map up because if schools were to follow that right now, 90% of the counties, 90% of the schools would not be able to open under the CDC's own metric. Was it a mistake for the CDC to connect school reopening to how much infection there is in a community?
Well, let's first say this, that in the last 4 weeks, schools are opening every week. More schools are opening. And it is because we are supplementing what needs to happen around the vaccinations getting into to states, but also because we're seeing progress. When folks are wearing masks, when they're getting vaccinated, when they're social distancing, we're seeing progress there. But we all want the schools to reopen. Savannah, all of us who have children in our lives, they want to go back to school. We want them to go back to school. Teachers want to teach.
But what about that CDC guidance then? That's the question, because the CDC is saying essentially their best guidance is don't open if you're in a red zone. 90% of students are in a red zone. And the science is very clear. The CDC's own science says schools are not a source of community risk.
Well, so here's the thing. What the CDC, what they have recommended are exactly that, recommendations about how to reopen safely if they've been closed, how to stay open if they've been opened. And so the recommendations include what, again, needs to happen around social distancing, hand washing, mask wearing. But the point is that we all want our kids to get back to school as quickly as possible and as safely as possible.
Oh, my goodness.
So, look, she keeps trying to say, look, first of all, let's not pretend anything different than reality. CDC spun like a whiplash-inducing turn when they had been messaging consistently schools should reopen, along with Anthony Fauci. And then we had this sudden shift from the CDC with this report saying, oh, well, now it's as if they got a phone call from Becky Pringle or Randy Weingarten or say, listen.
They did. They did. I have evidence of that.
Okay.
Check it out. Washington Post. Article from the Washington Post. The CDC met with more than 70 organizations as they crafted the upcoming guidelines because, you know, these lobbying groups have all of the, they know the science better than the actual CDC. According to the person familiar with the outreach who is not authorized to discuss it, of course, groups range from the country's two major teachers unions, whose presidents met directly with Biden's CDC head, to organizations supposed to focus on children, yada, yada, yada. But we all saw what happened, right? The CDC director was saying that, you know, you don't need the teachers to be vaccinated to reopen. Schools can reopen safely. And then Biden's press secretary was like, oh, hold up. Wait a second. We're talking about this a little more. That wasn't actually from the CDC, even though the CDC director is the one who said it. And then the CDC director has been spinning the message since then. And there, we will go over in a little bit some clips with Jake Tapper from CNN. Got to give him props. He really pushed back against the CDC director. So,
and again, I mean, this has been, since the inauguration, we're now suddenly seeing Jake Tapper from CNN, Savannah Guthrie from NBC. All these people suddenly say, oh, look, wow, the parents are having a problem with this teachers' union bargaining chip. If we're going to not reopen until we get cash as a bargaining chip backroom deal. Suddenly the networks find the parents' point of view within weeks of the inauguration. So there's that, but at least you could say, well, thank goodness they're finally, at least now.
I'm glad they're pushing back now. It's better than them never changing, but you're right. The timing is weird because it seems like, you know, Trump was calling to reopen the schools and the media didn't like Trump. So they said it was so dangerous to reopen the schools and did a lot of fear mongering. And now they've switched, but I'm glad they switched either way.
I want to make fun of it, but it also enrages me, Corey. A month ago, there was nothing substantially different in the science, in the transmission rates, in the mask wearing, in the anything. It was all pretty much the same landscape 1 month ago, and yet these questions were not asked. So anyway,
We did have the data from Sweden and other countries, Singapore and other countries, Ireland. The UNICEF did a report of 191 different countries finding no consistent link between reopening schools and community transmission. You had even Governor Cuomo saying that they weren't seeing spread in the schools. And consistently, we've seen that the positivity rate in the schools, Anthony Fauci, closed the bars, opened the schools. He said something along the lines of we're seeing very little evidence of spread among children within and from children in the schools as well.
You got to see Kamala Harris there ask several times, is the CDC wrong? Is the CDC wrong? But the CDC new guidelines consulted with the teachers union that you just showed, Corey, shows 90% would be closed. But at the same time, their own science shows that they're not super spreading places that the schools are safe. So you see Kamala not answer. Now, Savannah Guthrie of NBC News Today Show goes on to the subject of how the Biden administration itself has moved the goalposts.
There has been a shifting timeline here. Back on December 8th, the president, then president-elect, tweeted, we want to reopen the majority of schools in the first 100 days. He later said that day, we want to have most schools open. Now he said, as recently as last night, he's talking about the majority of K through 8 schools. Last week, we heard a White House official saying open means it could mean just one day a week open. The president said, no, that was a miscommunication. But I mean, I guess, look, again, parents watching, what is the bottom line? What does it mean for schools to be reopened? And how soon can they be reopened?
So our goal is that as many K through 8 schools as possible will reopen within the first 100 days. Our goal is that it will be 5 days a week. And so we have to work to achieve that goal. But our goal is the goal of parents. And I mean, here's the thing, Savannah, I don't need to tell you. We are, the issue here is not just about statistics. It's about our kids. It's about their parents. It's about the fact that every day our kids are missing essential, critical days in their educational development. You know, we know, we have worked on this issue for years around the fact that, you know, by the end of third grade, if a child is not at third grade reading level, they literally drop off. So each day in the life of a child is a very long time.
Absolutely.
And that's why, right, and that's why we've got to collectively do everything in our power to reopen our schools as quickly as possible and as safely as possible.
Well, they call out the CDC guidelines for what they are, a bunch of bogus guidelines based on community transmission when the schools aren't significantly leading to increases in community transmission. That's the biggest issue with the CDC guidelines is that it includes the community transmission when that could be totally different from the school transmission.
Yeah, one little other gripe from my point of view is that Savannah Guthrie says these long-awaited CDC guidelines for schools, as if there had never been CDC guidelines under Trump for schools. There were at least two rounds of CDC guidelines for school reopenings, maybe more. I personally saw two previous sets of CDC school reopening guidelines, and Savannah Guthrie calls it long-awaited. I guess that means this is the union version of school reopening. So you have that. So again, she's like saying, like being asked, though, Kamala Harris being asked, you know, what about, you know, how soon can schools reopen? That was the literal question out of her mouth. And then what does Kamala Harris say? Like, oh, we just all have to try as hard as we can. So no answer to that. The pièce de résistance is part three of this trilogy, where for the first time, I'm seeing a question about if teachers, about vaccinations and teachers, and and Savannah Guthrie directly asking several times, Kamala Harris, do the teachers have to be vaccinated to go back to school? And listen to what Kamala does.
Public health officials will say this closing of schools is as much of a public health crisis for all the reasons you mentioned. A final point on this before we move on. You know, the CDC has said it is not a prerequisite for teachers to be vaccinated for them to go back to school. But many teachers are wary of going back to school. And we've had some cities have to sue the teachers union or sue their own school districts to try to get these schools to reopen. Can you reassure teachers who are listening right now that it is safe for them to go back to school even if they are not vaccinated, if these public health measures like distancing and masks are being implemented?
So first of all, let me just say this, and the president has said it, and we're all really clear. Teachers should be a priority. Teachers should be a priority. Look, let me just tell you something. I love teachers. My first grade teacher, Mrs. Frances Wilson, attended my law school graduation. Teachers are critical to our children's development. They should be able to teach in a safe place and expand the minds and the opportunities of our children. So teachers should be a priority along with other frontline workers, and we're going to make them a priority. I believe that 22 states, I believe, have prioritized teachers in terms of vaccinations.
But if they're not vaccinated, is it safe for them?
Well, I think that we have to decide if we can put in place safe measures. This is why, and it's so important, we pass the American Rescue Plan. The American Rescue Plan, which the president and I have proposed, is a plan that is about getting our schools back open. Why does this connect with what we're talking about right now? It's going to be safer for our schools to reopen when we can get our schools the infrastructure needs, like helping them with their ventilation systems, helping them create social distancing with barriers, the things that are necessary to get them back open in a safe
way. But I don't want to beat it to death, but I know there are teachers listening, and the CDC has said they don't have to be vaccinated to go back to school. Of course, it's the priority.
We think they should be a priority. We think they should be a priority, and the states are making decisions individually about where they will be on the list of who gets vaccinated. I believe they should be a priority. The president believes they should be a priority.
Oh my goodness! What a dodge, dude! I am just not going to answer. I'm just not going to answer. I'm just going to say teachers should be a priority over and over again.
The only thing you wish Savannah Guthrie would have done in addition is saying, so people listening for you to answer the question of is it safe to go back if they're not vaccinated? Are you not going to answer the question, is it safe to go back if teachers aren't vaccinated, Ms. Vice President? Are you not going to answer that? That's the one last thing a journalist can do, because then everyone gets it. I think everyone gets it anyway, but just in case some people in the back row didn't hear it with all the dodging and weaving between the Biden administration moving the goalposts, between was the CDC guidance wrong? No answer to that either. And then if teachers aren't vaccinated, is it still safe to go back? The CDC says yes. Are they right? No answer, no answer, no answer. There you have it. Vice President.
She made the question pretty clear about if they're not vaccinated, but you do have all the safety measures in place as the CDC has recommended, should the teachers feel okay about going? She would not answer because.
It's like, see no evil here. I can't understand. Sorry, there's a mic problem. She should have faked that. It would have been more convincing. You know, like, oh, my earpiece is not working.
Well, then she just pivoted to, we just need more money for all these things.
Yes,
but the question was, if they had all of the safety precautions in place,
Right. Teachers are priority. It's like right out of the, was there a union press release sitting in front of her on the desk saying teachers are a priority? She had to repeat their talking points no matter what the question was. That's what it sounded like. But then as you're, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to point out the quote from the CDC researchers in JAMA that I believe the reporter was pointing out. And then, you know, the quote was also cited in the Washington Post recently. The report says, there is little evidence that schools have contributed meaningfully to community transmission. And then the author of this piece went on to say, well, then why tie the reopening schools to community spread? We all know why, because that's the limiting factor that keeps 99% of schools closed, even though the science suggests that it's a less important measure than the others.
Well, in a similar vein, this same week, first of all, another noteworthy thing just quickly is that Savannah Guthrie mentioned the word unions for the first time in the context of school closures. This had not happened before this week. Since COVID began, you have seen interview after interview after interview about school closures, school reopenings, school closures, school reopenings. Never once have I heard a national interview use the word union. I tweet about this all the time. I'll see story after story about even the harm caused to kids with continued closures, suicides, drug abuse, all kinds of problems. Never the word union. They won't say it. Finally, this week, now that the inauguration is over, we get two major networks, what you just saw from the Today Show, and then what you're about to show from Jake Tapper on CNN.
Yeah, so here's a Jake Tapper quote mentioning the unions as well, with the CDC director that kind of went back and forth after the meetings with the unions, the two teachers unions bosses. So here's the CDC director kind of getting a lot of pushback from Jake Tapper. And you got to give Jake Tapper props for actually pushing back on this. And CDC director looks very uncomfortable because she's not on the side of truth in these interviews.
That a lot of teachers are very concerned. And I know that teachers unions have been pushing back on this. But it sounds to me like you're asking for 100% mask compliance and a number of measures that we're never going to be able to achieve. And that makes me feel like, boy, I don't know if the schools are ever going to open until everybody's vaccinated.
And here's another follow-up.
I have to say, I feel a little dispirited after this conversation because I had high hopes that schools would be able to resume in-person learning because so many scientists and health officials, including you and Dr. Fauci and others, have been talking about the science supports opening the schools as much as possible. I know that a lot of teachers are very concerned, and I know that teachers' unions have been pushing back on this, but it sounds to me like you're asking for 100%.
And here
100%
is,
compliance, he said.
Yeah, he's saying, I don't think this school is ever going to open with this. And here's one more from Tapper pointing out that, look, the CDC itself has said there isn't community transmission, the same quote that I read just a second ago.
According to our analysis of federal data, that includes 99% of American children. But you have said, quote, there's very little transmission happening in the schools. CDC researchers just wrote in JAMA that, quote, there's been little evidence that schools have contributed meaningfully to increased community transmission. So why give schools that opt not to open up?
And here is her full response and then the last response from Jake's. He's not having it.
It's a really great question. In that red zone that you're referring to, and in fact, yes, many of our Kern counties are in that red zone, although our numbers continue to decline. But in that red zone, we advocate for hybrid elementary school because we believe those K-5 kids are A, transmitting less, and B, really essential to have back in the classroom. And if you're in middle school or high school, we would advocate for virtual learning for that group. Or if you're able to do strict six feet of distancing in those classrooms to open remotely in a hybrid way.
But President Biden has promised to always follow the science. Can you point to any scientific reasons for students in the United States not to return to in-person classes tomorrow, as long as schools are taking the five steps that we refer to earlier, masking, cleansing, et cetera? Why not open the schools right now?
The whole interview was great. There's more clips I have too, but as you can see, he's pushing back and the CDC director looks pretty, throughout the interview, just very uncomfortable. dodging questions, not as much as Kamala Harris was dodging questions, to be clear, but it was a really uncomfortable interview even to watch, just because of the non-answers.
Yeah, let me try to calm down, Corey. I think that interview on CNN should be in the Museum of Broadcasting, and here's why. What I was watching were both parties pivoting from what had been their positions for months. So Jake Tapper, as I just pointed out, and CNN and all the rest of the mainstream media were never referencing union blockage of reopening schools before. They were never mentioning Anthony Fauci, repeating anyway, that Anthony Fauci had recommended reopening before. They were never taking the parents' side in these issues before. So CNN flipped their point of view on that. At the same time, the CDC had been so pro-reopening, for months, talking about how it was safe to reopen schools. And after the union meetings you just showed, we saw the CDC flip to all of these preconditions, meaning no red zones. So 90% of the schools, one might infer, should remain closed. Imagine an interview where both sides have these positions they've said for months, and then both the interviewer, who claims to be objective but is opinionated, we know, the interviewer and the interviewee both flip positions. Jake Tapper said in that interview, listen how high my voice gets when I get excited. Jake Tapper said in the interview, I'm confused. He was confused that she was pivoting. He thought he was the only one pivoting. But they were both pivoting, and Jake Tapper said live on the air, I'm confused, because he wasn't expecting her to pivot too.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's crazy, and who knows what's going to happen. But look, I mean, the CDC guidelines are out, and they don't look that great when you look at the community transmission piece of the puzzle that shouldn't have been included.
The title of our episode today is not all this. What is the? Do you have the image for our episode today?
Oh yes, it's amazing.
Before we get to just specifics, I know you have good stuff on this, but what's your favorite state initiative right now when you look at that map?
So there are two that I'm particularly interested in.
Let's see if it's the same as mine. Go ahead.
One is West Virginia, and West Virginia just passed a charter school law like 2019, and I don't even know if they have any
charter schools yet.
Yeah, I don't even know. So they had trouble passing a charter school law, but this past week, they're going bananas passing things out of committees on voice votes. And their program is huge. It is nearly universal. About 93% of families with school-aged children would be eligible for this program. This is a huge, this would be a huge expansion of educational freedom. And they actually just did a voice vote amendment today in order to make it 100% universal, because the homeschool groups and private school families were pushing their legislators saying, we shouldn't be left out of this, because they had a requirement before they had to switch out of a public school. And they do this in order to save taxpayer money, because every person that was paying out of pocket, that's an additional expense for the taxpayer. So they just voice voted and approved an amendment.
The value of their education savings account in dollars?
It would be about $4,600, I want to say, maybe $5,000, because they spend about $13,000 per student per year, and it's up to the maximum state funding amount, which tends to be about half or a little less than half.
And it's a lower cost of living state also. So
that's one, and then pretty close to West Virginia, New Hampshire is on my radar, and they just had a hearing on it today. But it's a similar proposal, which is nearly universal, would be a pretty expansive program. And so those are two states that I've been keeping an eye on. But there are four states that have passed, out of these 22, four of the states have passed the bills out of chambers, either the Senate or the House, and that is Indiana, Iowa, let's bring the map up, Arizona, and Kansas. Indiana, Iowa, Arizona, and Kansas have each at least passed one bill to expand funding students instead of systems in the past month. And then four other states have gotten bills out of committee, and that includes Florida. Arizona has some out of committee that are not out of the chamber yet. South Dakota, and there's a couple of others too, but the big ones are the ones that have passed chamber votes already, and then they're all moving forward, and if they get killed, I'll take it off the map. But we have 22 in play right now.
Plus Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Last time we did the show and you said something about Wisconsin after we got off, I started looking into the Wisconsin thing, and then I couldn't find a link to the bill, so I still haven't added it yet.
Oh, okay.
But if you want to send me a link to the bill and showing the expansion, I'll be able to.
Well, I was going to say, I was going to extol the virtues of Iowa because you have a governor there, Kim Reynolds, who's been very supportive. It's not just a bill in a legislature somewhere. And you pointed out that there's a big difference between just a bill somewhere that some state senator proposes and an actual momentum. That's a big difference than the fact that a bill exists. So I think the big push from the governor there, they, of course, so this is from yesterday's Iowa Public Radio website. Governor Kim Reynolds is prioritizing school choice legislation this year, including a voucher-style program for students of low-performing public schools. But opponents of the bill say it would come at the cost of students who choose to stay. Well,
no, at least better outcomes in the public schools.
Yeah, and of course they write in this piece, you know, it's the public radio station, right? So filter through that lens. But they write about how the kids of the district schools will end up with a higher percentage, special needs and low income if you create a school choice program, which would be terrible to have this disparity or increase in percentage of special needs and low income. And I tweeted, oh, that's funny, because there are all kinds of public school district schools that for years have had enormous disparities in terms of percentage of special needs and low income. That was never a problem before when it was a complete. Disparities in special needs and disparities in low income between district schools. Never talked about. Or maybe if it was talked about, it was certainly not worthy of giant legislation to fix. Not some big problem. Suddenly, those disparities become this overwhelming, hand-wringing, fake concern once competition is introduced as a proposal, which had never been a concern when it was all districts.
And I mean, look, this Iowa bill is only targeted to if you're residentially assigned to a quote-unquote failing school as deemed by the state. I think it's only like 32 different school districts in the state, which is a very small amount. What's interesting is the ESA, Education Savings Account funding, is about $5,000, which $5,200, which is about the same as the average private school tuition in the state. But the public schools spend about $15,000 per student per year. So they get to keep a ton of the money even after the students leave using the school choice program. So they actually financially benefit on a per pupil basis. I do have some quotes from the governor, and I think you're right. I've looked at a lot of the state of the state or condition of the state addresses by the governors to see if they would mention school choice, if they have a bill in their legislature right now. And most of them haven't said a lot about it. They've kind of hinted at it, but the Iowa governor came out loudly and proudly in favor of education savings accounts in her condition of the state address. And that is not the correct. Here it is. She said, we should create education savings accounts for students who are trapped in a failing school. Let's give them another choice by making sure money isn't their barrier. She went on to say, school choice isn't a zero-sum game. It has the potential to raise the quality for all schools. And for those schools that do fall behind, it ensures our children don't fall with them. And she concluded by saying, let's work together to make sure every child receives a quality education, regardless of income and no matter their zip code. And she has also said on the radio recently, she started to use the fund students, not systems kind of terminology. Yeah, she said something around.
Where'd she get that from?
I don't know. I think I might have met with her a couple weeks ago or something.
Yeah.
But she later on that day, she ended up saying, it's not about the system, it's about the student. So she's getting the right message when it comes to how to make the case for school choice. But she's been doing it all along. She's been an advocate of school choice all along. So I think Iowa is another place to look, especially when it's one of the four places that have passed a bill out of a full chamber. Their Senate passed it like, I think it was 26 to 21 with three absent. So they got
just,
it done.
Just something just for those who may be listening or watching that are, I may have said this before, but a mistake I see made consistently in state legislation for school choice around the country is this geographic limitations you just described in the Iowa plan. That's what they did in a lot of original charter school plans, for example. They were limited to certain cities. Or the original Milwaukee voucher program, for example, was just limited to one city. And then Racine, Wisconsin was added. These places where there was a Cleveland voucher bill that was just Cleveland. These geographic limitations to choice are the wrong approach generally. I understand that legislators and governors don't want to be accused of fomenting sudden chaotic revolution in schools. Oh, there's just going to be a wild west that's going to be completely crazy, an overturning of everything. They want to not be accused of fomenting a chaotic revolution. But the answer to that is what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin after the Milwaukee and Racine voucher programs, which was a statewide but capped to 1% the first year. And then the subsequent year, it became 2%. Now, I say capped. I mean, each district could only allow 1% of its students to be eligible for the private school choice program. The following year, it could be 2% eligible for the private school choice program, and so on. That's how you scale. That's how you avoid being called a advocate of chaos, rather than these geographic limits.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the better way to do it. But at the same time, if you do it for everyone, then it's hard. You don't get the same kind of argument you can make with, oh, well, this is just for failing schools. But I mean, the reality is a school that's deemed an A can be failing for an individual student. So, I mean, any school can be failing for an individual, regardless of what the state says about that particular school for the average student. So I think you're right.
He's getting his butt kicked every day, or she is getting relentlessly mocked and abused on online bullying, or all kinds of reasons.
Well, you know what? The teachers union comes out just as hard and brings the same amount of fear mongering and attacking, whether it's 0.1% of eligibility or if it's 100% eligibility. So you might as well go big or go home, because your legislators are going to get the same pressure from the unions. And they're going to say the sky is falling, regardless of how big the program is.
Yeah. I think you're insulated from that landing as hard for independent sort of apolitical voters who get told both things. And you could be a candidate saying, look, they say I'm going to cause this absolute abject chaos. They're talking about 1%. If they still have 99% of the students, how much chaos can losing 1% bring? It's ridiculous. I think the apolitical,
especially
voter,
when you get to keep a lot of the money for kids who are no longer there. I mean, this is a good deal. Do private schools get to keep your tuition payments, or like 50% of your tuition payments after you leave? No, of course not. And they'd be happy if they did. The public school should be happy too.
Or if the closest public hospital gets to keep part of your Medicare and Medicaid funding when you go to a private hospital with your Medicare and Medicaid funding. Oh, look, geographically, your closest private hospital, you're siphoning money away from your closest, public. You're siphoning money away from your closest public hospital by choosing this private hospital with your Medicaid and Medicaid funding.
Pell grants steal money from community colleges because they can be used at state universities or private universities. So we better get rid of Pell grants.
Your closest four-year state school. Yeah, your closest four-year state university. Like you should be assigned to that.
Worse than that. Just imagine if the Pell grants, 20% of the Pell grants stayed with the community college, and the community colleges kept complaining after you started going to another university. It's worse than the analogies that we use, because of the fact that the public schools get to keep so much of the money even after the children leave. Did you see the nonsense that's going on in Arizona? This is actually,
please do tell.
This is nuts. Okay, so I tweeted out, I've tweeted out a couple of days ago, breaking, as I do all the time, breaking news. Arizona Senate just passed a bill to expand funding students instead of systems. This is a pretty big expansion. As you know, Bob, they already have an education savings account program that's available to about 20% of the population. It's mostly students with special needs. And they passed it 16-14, a party line vote. The Republicans, I believe, all voted for. The 14 Democrats, I believe, all voted against Senate Bill 1452. But it passed with the majority of the votes, and it started making its way to the House of Representatives because it would still need to get passed there and signed by Governor Ducey to become into law. This expansion would take that percentage of 20% to about 70-75% of the population.
Oh my goodness, really?
This is over a tripling of the education savings account program in Arizona. This would be huge.
A tripling of the eligibility, you're saying?
Over tripling of the eligibility.
How about the financial, like, is it capped in terms of the dollars going into the program or in some other way like that where it could
I'd have to look into it. I just know the eligibility is over tripled. So that seems pretty.
Because there'd been a big lawsuit. You know, they had basically gone for the universal ESA, and then there was this big lawsuit, and then they kind of ended up going back to the original special needs only.
Was that the ballot?
Yeah, they started with special needs, and then they eventually added like military families, kids of military families were eligible, and they added some other interesting eligibility criteria on the margins. But they had then it kind of went to universal ESAs, and then it got caught up in this whole thing. I'm pretty sure the Arizona Supreme Court was involved, and then it kind of got pulled back, and so.
And
they're
now re-expanding
it, which sounds like good news.
Well, I haven't gotten to the juicy part yet.
Oh, good.
So gets out of the House, 16-14 vote a couple of days ago. Something happened yesterday where the bill sponsor voted against the party on another bill. So they have a 16-14 Republican-Democrat majority. That one vote switching over made it a 15-15 vote on this other bill. I didn't know it wasn't an education bill, I don't think. And so that was a 15-15. It didn't pass out of the Senate. And so one of the other Republicans, as what it appears to be a form of retaliation against this bill sponsor, filed a motion to claw the bill back from the House to the Senate to revote on it in the Senate. As it seems like a way to punish the bill sponsor for, hey, you didn't vote my way on my bill. Now I'm going to try to, I don't know what, if that's the case, but it really seems like that's kind of what's going on. And they voted for a request. They voted on a motion to request the bill back from the House, and that passed. But the House, it's in their court now. They can say, no, we're not giving it back to you. So that's going to have to go to a vote in the House.
Oh.
And it could be the case that they, even if they do get it back, maybe tempers kind of calm down and everybody's kind of starts to realize like, well, you know, like why would we kill two of the Republican bills just because we're mad at a particular person? Oh, and by the way, why would we block choice for thousands and thousands of low-income families? Why would we do that? Maybe it's still looking okay, but this was a big kind of thing going on, at least in the social media sphere in Arizona yesterday. Senate Bill 1452.
Principled sausage making going on in Arizona. Okay. Any other state base you want to hit?
And yesterday the big news was the full Indiana House passed their bill to create a new education savings account program. It is a special needs targeted program. A lot of people would prefer it to be open to everybody, but as you know, you get the foot in your door with these things, and sometimes they expand over time. And that vote was a 61-38 vote. So it passed pretty easily out of their House of Representatives. It now goes to the Senate. But yeah, that's where we're at. 22 states now on the list of active legislation in this new wave to expand school choice, which could have been sparked by a lot of the teachers' unions keeping the schools closed and overplaying their hand.
Yes, well put. I wanted to mention quickly this issue of a federal bill. This was a Daily Caller link that I sent you. And it reads, Representative Dan Bishop, I like how like everyone knows who he is, to introduce bill combating school closures. And we've kind of talked a lot about this a little before, but this is a North Carolina U.S. representative in, introducing legislation this week aimed at combating school closures and giving families more options during coronavirus. The bill called Creating Hope and Opportunity Through Increased Choice in Education, the CHOICE Act, will authorize opportunity grants, which will provide financial assistance to families in public school districts that are not offering full-time in-person education. The income-based grants, so means-tested, rich people do not apply, need not apply, can be used by families to pay tuition at private schools, purchase education materials, or pay for homeschooling or micro schools. So again, my concern about this sort of legislation is that it's kind of a thing where before it can even get started, schools could kind of reopen and then close again and then reopen again. And like, it's often elusive to define how many days a school, public district school, must be closed before something like this triggered. And they can also game it by different sort of, you know, hybrid learning that's somewhat in person and somewhat not. So I'm a little skeptical of some of this, but I thought it was worth mentioning for our show.
Don't they define it as full-time in person, right? So if it's hybrid, the child would still be able to access this grant program.
How many days have to be full-time in person? So what if they close for all of February and then parents go to apply for this thing and then the school reopens on March 14th or something. And, and then all the parents then give up and then they close again on April 3rd. Like, I'm just kind of saying sometimes I wonder, maybe it's a great idea. Maybe I'm being too critical.
I think it's better than nothing, right? Right now, all of the money just goes to school buildings, regardless of whether they open or not. And the Senate, you know, just a couple of weeks ago voted on an amendment to their budget, the federal budget, and they were trying to get it to the COVID relief funds would only go to schools if they reopened in person, after all, given that all the teachers were vaccinated. And they voted 50-50 on party lines to block the amendment. So now none of the schools will be required to reopen, even if they have all of their teachers vaccinated, and they can still get billions of extra dollars despite not even reopening in person, which is pretty tragic. And I think this is kind of a response to that, this CHOICE Act.
Elephant in this room is, look, in this U.S. House of Representatives, there's no chance this is going to pass anyway. No. Who thinks this is going to pass? It's more probably about the press maybe reporting on it or something, messaging, things like that. I don't think anyone
knows. Well, I'm glad they're talking about it, right? I'm glad they're at least putting these things out there, even if we, you know, it's unlikely it's going to get any movement out of the House of Representatives. I think that's pretty obvious at this point. But yeah, I mean, just another detail is it would be 10% of any additional COVID relief aid would be for this program. So it's dollars that would be allocated anyway. So a lot of libertarians may be watching this and say, oh, I don't want a federal school choice program, but it isn't that, because it's not an expansion. It would be a federal program, but it isn't an increase in federal involvement, because it's simply using funding that would go to schools and then redirecting it to people instead of the school buildings.
Another thing, I was asked on an interview last week, you probably would have had a better answer than me, Corey. I was asked, well, what percentage of district regular public schools are open right now, Bob? And I'm like, Hamana, I don't know. It's different in every state. It's different within each state. It changes every week or every day. But yep. One thing I found interesting was a New York Times link that I sent you about Oregon, which basically said that 80% of the Oregon public schools are right now closed for in person. And I was struck by that. I thought to myself, 80% in Oregon sounds like, I would have never guessed anything that high. In my mind, maybe Portland would be, and maybe, Salem, I don't know, couple of bigger cities, but then the whole rest of the state, I would think, would be open for business, so to speak, meaning kids in schools. But
Nationwide, I believe it's about 60 to 70%, maybe around closer to 60%. Are public schools are open at least hybrid. That's not full-time in person. I believe only like a third are full-time in person. But if you include hybrid, it's a majority of schools. So that's why a lot of people were saying, like, when Joe Biden's press secretary was saying that, oh, yeah, the goal is to have majority of schools open for at least one day a week. People were already saying, well, we already have that. We already have a majority of public schools open at least one day a week. So what is the point of your ambitious 100-day plan to reopen schools?
But yeah. And just one more thing about this, about if you could pull up the New York Times link, just if I haven't already fostered enough conspiracy theories about the media, there it is. Here again, the same week that we see Jake Tapper on CNN, we see Savannah Guthrie on NBC, we have the vaunted New York Times tying these two things that, remember, I was complaining on this show. Why can't they talk about vaccines and teachers in the same story? If teachers' unions insist on schools being closed, why do they never bring up the vaccine? What if all the teachers are vaccinated? Do they still have a right to hold out for more money before returning to work? Well, what do we have? The headline of the New York Times story saying vaccinating teachers might not be enough. They are tying together the union's opposition to in-person education and the science of vaccines in a story for the first time.
Let's go.
So this week in the New York Times, suddenly they're discovering all these things that I've been yelling about. And, you know, so it's more, yet more of kind of a media shift.
So wait, did the governor, what was the main point from the governor? Or was it not the governor not weigh in on this?
I mean, I think the governor is kind of, you know, pushing for reopenings, and the unions are saying no, and there's like these stalemates, you know, that kind of thing.
Have you seen the this whole controversy about, and I think this blew up on Twitter yesterday or the day before, someone found numbers from the CBO suggesting how much of the $130 billion federal dollars that are probably going to go to K-12 public schools, that only $6 billion is actually planned, budgeted to go to schools in 2021. And then in 2022, only about $30 billion. And it's like spread out all the way through 2028. What's your take on that? Why? I mean, we don't have a lot of clear answers at this point, but
So just to clarify what you said, you're saying the COVID relief money is spread out that many years, or some different?
The $128 billion in COVID relief to reopen the schools in person. Here the number is $32 billion in 2022, $6 billion in 2021. The rest of the money would be paid out through 2028. Here is the
COVID relief money will be paid out through 2028. That is
and only
extraordinary.
And through 2022, it's only about less than $40 billion out of the $128 billion. So less than a third paid out by the end of next year.
So COVID, you're telling me COVID could be completely 100% gone from planet Earth? Go back 100 years. Look at the Spanish flu from 1918. That was gone in 2 to 3 years, completely gone. And there was no vaccine back then in 1918 for the Spanish flu. It killed a lot more people. It was completely gone from planet Earth with no vaccine in 3 years. This money will be still arriving at schools potentially years after COVID is gone.
So
that is a scandal.
My take on this was, either they think that that COVID's going to be around all the way through 2028, and they got to keep doing the mitigation stuff for that long, and they got to spread out the money and do it that way, or they don't think that, and they only believe it's going to cost $6 billion to get the schools open this year. And then the question is, well, why is there $122 billion more dollars pumped into the system if you only believe that it's going to take $6 billion to get it
open? I've never heard that before. That should be a screaming headline on the tops of
on Fox News.
Okay, but I mean, wow. No, but that's But that's okay. Fraction of it. Okay, you're right. They should have shown the. They should have given the fraction. Actually, they should have given the fraction. But all right. Well, in our last few minutes, I actually want to hit something else, which is, you know, there were a few kids in Baltimore, Maryland, whose grades might have been changed. You know, like 30 kids or 60 kids or 80 kids. Man. Oh wait, actually, it was 90,000.
How many? What?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It wasn't 30 or 60. Actually, 90,000 school kids whose grades might have been changed by our oh-so-accountable traditional public schools. You know, this is the kind of thing. I don't need to tell you or our viewers or listeners how this would be reported if it had been a giant charter school network, say.
You
imagine?
Fraud.
You imagine? Right.
Yep.
Or even, who knows, you know, private schools or something cheating on some sort of standardized test or any kind of, I don't know, graduation rates or something like that. So, you know, to those who believe that, you know, public school boards are, you know, create a high degree of accountability. You know, these are, of course, it reminds me of Atlanta about, I don't know, 8 years ago when the Atlanta cheating scandal was in national news. But 90,000 grades, that's collusion. Like, that's not one rogue teacher. I'm sorry.
So they just gave everybody A's or passing grades, even though they weren't doing anything.
Limited details so far, but it's it is widespread collusion. It is a conspiracy. You want to say conspiracy? This is evidence of a conspiracy.
Bob. I mean, you can't blame them because it's really hard this year and, you know, they just don't have enough money in Baltimore public schools. So if they had more money, if we double the spending there from
they wouldn't have
whatever it is
grades.
Now, like $25,000 per student or whatever it is, to $50,000, they wouldn't have to change the grades because then they do a better job at motivating the kids and
I don't mean to make light of the widespread student failure that the last 12 months has wrought. Yes, there actually, I'm sure there is quite a bit of, it goes without saying. The failure is everywhere in traditional public schools the last 12 months. I mean, but you can't change the grades. That basically covers up the problem. That basically says, you know, we'll pretend there is no problem. That's no way to fix any problem.
And this is different from other districts that have said, oh, well, we're going to come out publicly and say we're not failing any kids this year. That's at least being transparent about you passing everybody through. This, it seems like it's because it's an investigation. It wasn't like something that was supposed to happen. And so then, you know, in the other districts where they come out and say it, you kind of know that the grades are phony for that year. But this, if it was never caught, would look like these kids didn't lose any learning from having schools closed all year. They did such a great job with remote learning.
Yes.
And I think that's the bigger problem. That's why this is such a big issue.
All right, thanks everybody. Please like, share, and subscribe. Please also click on the Choice Media email blast to get our best in class Friday weekly email.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you guys so much. Good talking to you, Bob. See everybody next week on the Random Assignment Podcast.